From the KTOO newsroom, I'm Zoe Gruskin with a statewide news update. The state announced Wednesday it's shutting down ferry service to Prince Rupert, British Columbia. That news has been met with shock and disappointment in Ketchikan. As KRBD's Eric Stone reports, the two communities have been linked by state ferry since 1963.
Ending ferry service from Prince Rupert will mean big changes for people trying to get from Southeast Alaska to the North American road system. That's according to Bob Sievertson, mayor of the city of Ketchikan.
It's, a cost-efficient option for kids going back to school and people going to see the doctors and you know, just getting out on vacation and things like that. So having it, limited or no service to Prince Rupert drastically affect how people move around in the state of Alaska.
Ketchikan Visitors Bureau Chief Patty Mackey says she recently used the ferry to take her son to college. She says it's essential for commerce.
We know from our research that the average ferry traveler who gets off the ferry and stays in Ketchikan, spends over $500, almost $600 during their visit on things like hotels and food and transportation and activities. So that is going to be a challenge.
She says the two communities are more than just neighbors.
Prince Rupert is Ketchikan's sister city. Long had a good relationship, and they depend on the economic benefits of the ferry system as much as Ketchikan or any Alaskan community does.
Prince Rupert Mayor Lee Brain released a statement Thursday saying he's headed to Juneau later this month to try to find a workaround with state transportation officials and the governor's office. Ketchikan City Mayor Bob Sievertson says he's concerned about how the fishing industry will get some of its products to market without a ferry link.
There's been some commerce in regards to shipping fish products and shellfish products south through the Marine Highway system on the road system through Canada are hooking up with their rail systems.
The announcement that the state is ending the Prince Rupert link comes as it says it cannot comply with a Homeland Security mandate to provide armed security for U.S. Customs agents conducting inspections on Canadian soil. U.S. law enforcement agents can't carry guns in Canada and, as of September 30th, are unwilling to work unless armed Canadian police stand by. But the state and city say there aren't enough Royal Canadian Mounted Police available to devote to the task, and the U.S. federal agency is unwilling to issue another waiver. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's office says it's, quote, aware of this and coordinating with federal agencies involved to determine a path forward. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced yesterday that millions of square miles of water in the Pacific Ocean are heating up. They're calling it a marine heat wave, and it's looking pretty familiar. KMXT's Kavitha George has more.
This new warming trend in the Pacific started in mid-June. Ocean surface temperatures are up 2 to 3 degrees, which doesn't sound like much, but when we're talking about the ocean, it's enough to call a heat wave. NOAA oceanographer Andrew Lysing was on a call Thursday with reporters talking about the heat wave.
This current event that we're seeing right now ends up being the second largest marine heat wave that we have seen since 1981. And the only thing that's been bigger has been that, what we call the blob of 2014-2015.
The blob was what people called the last marine heat wave in the Pacific. It wreaked havoc on the Pacific food chain, including the Gulf of Alaska, prompting multiple fishery disaster declarations. Both the blob and the current heat wave stand out as outliers, according to Lysing, both in size and strength. According to NOAA researcher Nathan Mantua, North Pacific waters were already a whole degree Celsius above normal due to climate change. And now this marine heat wave is making things worse, especially in places like the Bering Sea and the Arctic.
Alaska has had its own heat wave for months, all year. It started long before this West Coast event.
It's too early to know what the impacts on marine ecosystems will be, but the last blob provides something of a roadmap for what we might see, like an increase in harmful algal blooms or a repeat of disastrously low salmon returns.
The ocean conditions can be stressful for the salmon if the temperatures get really warm and their food supplies are very poor.
Unfortunately, right now is not the best time to see the effects of warming on the ecosystem. Scientists are already looking ahead to spring when juvenile salmon start returning to the ocean, and things like algal blooms are more likely. And they're not just concerned about salmon, they're worried about all productivity in the food web being down, from plankton to seabirds and marine mammals. Despite the current alarm, it's important to note that the 2019 event is still fairly young, meaning the heat isn't as deep in as it was during the blob. It took several months to build, but researchers like Mantua still think it's possible that the heat wave will dissipate quickly before having a severe effect on the ecosystem. In Kodiak, I'm Kavitha George.
Southeast's landless tribal communities want to form 5 new village corporations out of 115,000 acres of Tongass National Forest. As KSTK's June Leffler reports, the effort has new cash, and it says the right political climate in Washington to finally get it done.
The 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act allotted millions of acres of land to 13 regional Native corporations, but some tribal communities were left out of the process. That's created a movement by the landless tribes in Southeast. It's an issue that's simmered for decades, but a recent infusion of $500,000 from regional corporation Sea Alaska has professionalized its efforts. At a meeting in August in Wrangell, Sea Alaska board member Richard Reinhart recalls the early 1970s when 200 village corporations were created across Alaska.
We all thought we were getting land just like everybody else, and then it was like a big surprise at the end that we didn't.
There's no apparent reason certain communities were left out. Those include the 5 Southeast tribes of Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Haines, and Tenakee Springs. Together, they are home to 4,400 Sea Alaska shareholders. Over the years, 4 bills were introduced in Congress to cede federal land to Southeast tribal communities. The most recent was the ANCSA Improvement Act, introduced by U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski in 2017. It didn't get far. Her office says there was a lot of opposition in Washington over parceling out a national forest. Now the Southeast Alaska Landless Corporation is crafting a 5th bill they hope Alaska's delegation will support. It'll be different than previous efforts in that it contains specifics, maps that are now being released as the Landless Corporation takes its message from community to community. The bill envisions 115,000 acres to be divided between the 5 landless tribes. Reinhart says the climate in Washington is right for reshaping public lands.
Today we have, under the Trump administration, new heads of the Forest Service, and they are in support. They will not fight us, and they want to sit down and talk with us.
USDA Forest Service Chief and Alaska's regional forester met with some of the shareholders and Sea Alaska's legal team last year. The Forest Service said in a statement they've given advice over existing land designations in the Tongass, but haven't signaled whether they support giving up management of any forest land. Conservation groups are wary about carving up the Tongass, but they say they're aware it's a complex issue that involves trying to right historic wrongs.
It's our hope that we can support them by working with them in partnership.
Meredith Trainer is the executive director for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council in Juneau. She says she supports tribal sovereignty, but not if it means public land is lost at the expense of subsistence users. SEAC opposed past efforts, but she says there are ways a new village corporation could get its land and be good stewards of the forest.
Such as, you know, being included in the carbon market and through carbon sequestration, where communities would actually be paid not to log the land.
Reinhart said that with the decline of the timber industry, carbon credits make sense. Sea Alaska is already in the carbon credit market. But the landless group says nothing, including logging, would be off the table. The campaign is traveling to all Southeast communities, releasing specific maps as it goes. The 5 maps would be available once its tour is completed next week. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
A national Muslim civil liberties group has resolved its federal lawsuit against the state of Alaska for providing what it says were insufficient meals to Muslim inmates fasting as part of their faith. Muslims abstain from food and drink during daylight hours during the month-long Ramadan holiday.
And so when they are in prison, that means that the Department of Corrections needs to provide them with meals after the sun goes down and before dawn.
That's Carolyn Homer, a trial attorney with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which sued the state last year. It alleged 2 inmates had to skip meals, lost weight, and guards punished them and confiscated any food they'd smuggled out of the dining hall to eat after sundown. But this year, the Department of Corrections amended its policies. Those were spelled out in a legal settlement. Muslim inmates will receive at least 3,000 calories a day, as federal guidelines require. They'll also be allowed to gather and pray 5 times a day and participate in Friday prayers. Homer says many of the policy changes were already in effect this spring during Ramadan.
They are now ensuring that all Muslim inmates in all facilities in Alaska receive 2 hot meals per day during the nighttime hours.
In a statement, the State Corrections top standards official Jeremy Ho says the department is committed to providing religious and cultural opportunities for inmates within available resources while maintaining security and safety. The state says it doesn't track the inmate population by religion, but 45 prisoners fasted for Ramadan this year. Alaska's prison population is around 4,900. The Alaska Supreme Court has ordered the state to pay about $100,000 in attorney's fees and other costs after losing a legal fight over abortion earlier this year to Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. In February, the court struck down as unconstitutional a state law and regulation seeking to define what constitutes medically necessary abortions for purposes of Medicaid funding. And a Southwest museum has received dozens of ancestral human remains to hold until they can be returned to a native tribe. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reported that the Aleutik Museum welcomed 38 ancestral human remains discovered southeast of Kodiak Island with funerary objects like blades, figurines, and metal fragments. The remains were unearthed in the 1960s by archaeologists from the University of Wisconsin-Madison before the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers discovered the collection. Museums and federal agencies were mandated to return certain Native American cultural items to lineal descendants as part of the 1990 Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. 66 degrees and sunny in Juneau. That's the latest from KTOO.